It is 7:07 in the Twin Cities, 70 degrees. Well, for a number of years now, we have been monitoring, as have been people all over the country, the decline in the honeybee population. A third of the nation's honeybee colonies died last year. And if this trend continues, many experts say this could actually threaten our food supply. My next guest is somebody who is a very familiar name, and I think people may know that he has this as a hobby on his hobby farm. Paul Coffey is actually, of course, the morning host on Buzzin'. And I wonder, did he have any say in the name? But anyway, he is also a beekeeper. Paul Coffey, a pleasure to have you on a Saturday. Thank you so much.
Hi, Esme. Good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Well,
on.
Listen, and I don't know, I certainly because you have done appearances about your beekeeping before, but is this something? And you have a hobby farm. You know, I have a hobby farm. But how did you get into this? I mean, how does one sort of suddenly decide, hey, you know, maybe I'd like to go into beekeeping?
It was a friend was introduced to it by a friend, and he got me into it, and it's one, like any hobby, you start diving into it and it gets interesting and fascinating and addictive. It's really like a chess game of sorts, and it's farming too, without as much work as actual farming.
Okay. And you know, what you said is just that you get more and more into it. And I, you know, another person that's well known, Don Shelby, who retired as the CCO television, a longtime anchor, a huge beekeeping guy, and just says this is, you know, the coolest thing. So you just started getting into it. And then, I mean, did your wife say, wow, this is going to be just awesome? Let's go out and get all this beekeeping equipment.
No, not at first. And then one year I was up here and she was in Dallas. One year I brought all the bees south and I said, you're going to have to take care of them. And then at that point, really nice of me. At that point, she became fascinated with the bees too. So she's just as, in awe of everything about it as what I am and what people who get into it end up being.
Well, let me ask you, in order to get into it, what kind of an investment do you have to make, both in terms of the layout, you know, just financially of trying to get the bees in the right habitat for them, and also the time commitment? Because I think people, you know, saying, well, gee, maybe if, you know, Paul Coffey, he's, you know, got a full-time job and he's, you know, a very busy guy. I'm sure you do many, many appearances, and yet you can do this. And they're saying, well, maybe I can do it too.
Well, it all depends on how engaged a person wants to be and what their take on it is going to be on how they want to manage the hive. To get into it, if you're buying new retail, you can plan on anywhere from $150 to $225 for the hardware to set the bees up, for everything that you would need for a season, and that doesn't include the bees. And then there are different avenues a person can take to get the actual bees as the livestock, which could range anywhere from $90 to $150.
So you're
just for the bees.
You know, so you're saying you could actually set this thing up for under $300?
Yes.
Okay. And in terms of, you know, forgive my ignorance here, I mean, do you have to have like where are your bees? I mean, are they in a barn or are they outside or do you have to have heat? I mean, what happens in the winter?
Ours are set a ways from the house because we're up near the Franconia Sculpture Garden.
Oh, that's beautiful. I know exactly where that is. Yes.
I'm actually parked it to the end of their driveway so I can have cell reception right now. But there's bear in the area, so you don't want to have the hive set too close to the house if you're in an area where there's bear. And you want them to have sun exposure, and they'll kind of do their own thing. And you check on them a couple times in the spring to make sure everything's going well. And then as you want to check them through the summer to make sure that they're adding the honey, you do that. And then you take the honey off right around state fair time and prep them for winter right around Labor Day.
Oh, okay. And for those folks who don't know where the Franconia Sculpture Park is, and it's very cool. I mean, it's very, very cool. It's right near Taylor's Falls, Minnesota, just a beautiful, beautiful area. So you got a little further away from the house. And so do you actually compete at the state fair?
Oh, no.
Okay.
We we have fun doing it. It's like I said, there's so many different facets to beekeeping, and each one of them is its own little Pandora's box to get into that you could take to whatever degree you want to. We're having fun raising bees and making some honey.
Right. Well, and I just, you know, I mentioned that because I actually, it's actually one of my favorite exhibits at the State Fair is to go to the honey exhibit. And if you haven't been there at the State Fair, it's really cool because the spectrum of colors of the honeys are so remarkable depending on what the bees have been, you know, eating and consuming, what kind of environment they're in. And it's just, I just think it's a really neat little thing. So that's just my little pitch for that.
Yeah, we have, I love basswood honey, and we have zinnia. We got zinnia honey because we've got an acre or two of just straight up zinnias that we plant to try and get a specialty flavor as well. So it's, and like I said, it's
wow. That is so cool. So you're planting zinnias because you want the bees to, you know, land on the zinnias and, you know, that would be their source of nutrition. Okay, that is so cool. And
the zinnias grew. So.
Okay, the zinnias grew, and they're pretty. Gosh,
yeah.
Okay, what? And I understand because I've done stories on beekeepers before. There's sort of, are you sort of in touch with other beekeepers? Because I know that for many people who are beekeepers, it's sort of a community.
Yes, there are. Each county has, most counties have their local beekeeping association that you can join, and there's hundreds, literally hundreds of different clubs that you can join. There's online communities and forums that people can ask questions and debate. And sometimes, I don't know if you've heard of this, on online forums, people will argue. there's all sorts of information where people can pull from and groups that people can join.
Right.
To decide what angle that they want to take to try and keep these bees alive.
Folks, if you think that perhaps my guest who's talking about beekeeping and is a beekeeper sounds awfully familiar, he is. He's Paul Coffey, the morning host on Buzzin', and he's talking to us about his hobby of beekeeping. Let me ask you, why do you think the bee population is struggling so mightily and so many colonies have been lost?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would love for there to be one answer and to be able to point the finger on one particular thing. But I think it is everything that everyone's been hearing about over the past couple of years. I think it is the insecticide, the neonicotids. I think it is the varroa mites and tracheal mites, which have been an issue. I think it's also the Africanized gene has gotten into the DNA of the bees, which makes them less cold hardy. Two people have pulled up on four-wheelers on this dirt road, so my chihuahua might bark.
Okay. That's okay. We're thrilled to have you and your chihuahua on the air.
And, you know, the landscape in America has changed as the agricultural industry has changed. From one, there just being pasture land as beef was a big thing, to the types of herbicides and pesticides that are used on the field and what the bees are able to eat, whether it's goldenrods growing up or not growing up now in cornfields because the fields are treated to, they're just not being the pasture land because there aren't as many cows. So, I mean, I think it's a lot of things, and it's all the things.
You know, and for people who think, well, gosh, you know, does this really affect me? Well, listen to this. One in every three bites of food, according to some experts, is directly or indirectly pollinated by honeybees, who pollinate about $15 billion worth of U.S. crops each year. Almonds, for instance, are completely reliant on honeybee pollination. So it is an enormous, enormous factor here. And what I'm going back to, you know, you're getting involved in beekeeping. Where does one purchase bees?
Well, there are a number of people across the state sell bees. Like my wife and I will sell bees in the spring.
Oh, so you mean people can buy Paul Coffey bees?
Yeah, my wife has started a little business called the Bee Lady, and we peddle in some supplies and we sell bees. And there are a number of people do it because the survivability is so hit and miss when you're this far north. And that's been the main question that people ask when they are getting into beekeeping is, well, how do you make them live through the winter? And it's like, well, as soon as someone figures out that definite answer, that will be what every single person does.
Okay. And this is the website, www.thebeelady.farm?
Dot farm, yeah.
All right. What a cute website with the catalog and the blog. So somehow your wife went from the woman who was like, you go down there and say, hey, here, you got to take care of the bees, to she's obviously gone mainstream here with the bees.
Yeah, she has, and that makes, you know, as a husband watching a wife get passionate about a business and a hobby, it's just really exciting for me to see her get fall in love with these guys.
Wow.
You know what? I had an idea, which I don't know if somebody listening to CCO could maybe spark this up a little more. With the food situation for the bees in Minneapolis and St. Paul losing so many trees this year and the next year to Dutch elm disease, that if we could replant where those trees are going to go missing with willow trees or basswood trees or something that's a food source for the bees, that could really turn the Twin Cities into a...
Right. Well, and I know that there are, I mean, just in my neighborhood, I know that there's, you know, a guy around the corner from us who has, you know, a big sign out on his yard, and it's a beautiful, you know, like all kinds of flowers, and he goes, this is a bee-friendly yard. What does that mean? Does that mean he's not using certain pesticides, or he's got a lot of flowers?
What ended up being the termed problem weeds in the spring are the first source of pollen and food for the bees. And so when people let their yard grow wild, it's because the bees can actually, that's their very first source of food. So if I can just narrate, a three-wheeler and a four-wheeler have died on the dirt road right in front of my car, and you may be hearing my dog bark.
Oh, that's okay. And if you need to go, we understand it. We appreciate your time. But
no, I just don't want that to be awkward. Like, the guy's talking and this dog just keeps going crazy. What are the odds?
Well, it does, and the folks, the website's really cool, and it has all kinds of supplies, www.thebeelady.farm. And obviously, you know, and you sort of have a platform. I mean, do you think, you know, people have kind of picked it up saying, you know, hey, they're Paul Coffey fans, and they think, well, gee, you know, maybe I'll try this.
I don't know. I think some people have, but I try and keep that just because of business is business, and that's fine. Any think that I'm abusing the platform.
All right. Well, listen, Paul Coffey, thank you so much for joining us. I want to give out your wife's website again because it's a great one. www.thebeelady.farm. And really a pleasure. We're losing the cell signal just a little bit. So.
Oh.
Okay. But I really want to thank you. And you know, you're one of these people who you're up super early. And, you know, it's really nice of you to take the time to be with us tonight. I mean, that's really above and beyond. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on. And it's lovely up here at the Franklin Sculpture Gardens, even if...
Okay. The one and only Paul Coffey, folks. Obviously, the host of Buzzin' does an awesome job. And how interesting and fascinating, too, that he was the one who got into the bees, and now it seems like his wife is just as passionate and has taken it to another level. And again, her website is very cool, www.thebeelady.farm. Neat stuff, folks. All right, we will take a break. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 7:23 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Great to be with you on a Saturday evening. Gosh, the temperature's actually going up. I think it was 68 or 69 when I first came in here, 71 degrees. Remarkable here after sort of a cold, chilly week. Still ahead here on this Saturday evening, we are going to talk with Mike Kempenich. He calls himself the Gentleman Forager. And we're going to talk to him about how do you actually forage for food, like mushrooms or all different kinds of things that you can eat, and how do you make sure you're not getting the poisonous kind of mushrooms. And then we're going to chat with the executive director of the Hook and Ladder and host of the Morel Fest, There is a Morel Fest coming up next weekend at the Hook and Ladder in Minneapolis. So it's an interesting concept. And I know my husband's a big Morel fan, and he actually found a stash. I can't reveal the location. I will tell you it was actually within the city of Minneapolis, and it was on private property. So we weren't like, because I know that there's sort of mixed rules, and we can ask them about it, where you can forage, where you can't forage. But this was on private property in Minneapolis. So interesting discussion there. And then at 8 o'clock, Professor David Schultz, I do want to ask him about sort of the latest developments in this ongoing saga of Russia. And the drip, drip, drip is almost like pour, pour, pour. The latest is that reports that Jared Kushner in December, so after his father-in-law, President Donald, or then candidate Donald Trump or President-elect Trump, had won the White House, Mr. Kushner reportedly tried to set up a secret channel of communications between the Trump team and Russia that would be using the Russians' means of communication. It's like the bottom line is why? Why would you need that? And that is something that is at every turn, there seems to be something new here, and it's not good. And the question is, the smoke, the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's an awful lot of smoke here, and the smoke signals from each of these unveilings and these revelations appears to be a little bit of a darker cloud. Hey, I do want to update you on a story that you heard about at the top of the hour. The Walker Art Museum, after a number of public protests and a huge amount of criticism, has decided that they will dismantle a new piece of art, a new sculpture that has been put in place at the Sculpture Garden at the Walker Art Center. This sculpture was called Scaffold, and it's a two-story high sculpture partly inspired by the gallows where 38 Dakota Indian were hanged in Mankato, Minnesota in 1862. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest they were accused of a rape, that they were innocent, that there was no due process at all. It has become really a blemish, I think most people feel, on the history of Minnesota. And certainly for Native American people, a deep, dark stain on the kind of persecution that they faced. Anyway, this thing looks like a gallows, and it was put up there in the Walker Sculpture Garden, and there were protests. And the Walker Art Museum, I will say, responded pretty quickly. And I think when you do have a crisis, I think most crisis management folks will tell you that it's better to respond quickly rather than sort of hemming and hawing and trying to figure out what to do with the situation. And it just didn't seem like it was had a place there. And I didn't see it up close. I've only seen photographs. I didn't see any context. I didn't see any sort of statement. It just looked like a replica of a gallows. And maybe I'm missing something here, but one could certainly see how that would be deeply offensive and problematic for people who are Native Americans. So we will continue to follow that story. It looked like that one was going to continue for some time, but the Walker basically ending it quite quickly, saying they are not, they're going to take it down. And again, looking at pictures of it here, it simply looks like a gallows. It's sort of chilling in a place where people, go to look at art, and then not that art can't be chilling or frightening or scary, but this looks just awfully, it looks like a recreation or recreation of a gallows that was used in that event. Anyway, so much more ahead. We are going to take a break and give you some weather. And then we are going to, after that, talk with two guests about foraging and also this Morel Fest that is coming up, and what are morels and how you should forage, what kinds of things you should look for, and what kinds of things you can find, what kinds of treasures you can find. And also, how do you know where to look? Because that's always the question, especially with morels. You never know where they're going to show up, that you can't cultivate them. So that's part of the mystique that surrounds them. So let's take a break. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. After the break, we'll give you some weather, and then we'll talk about foraging in our next half.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
7:34 in the Twin Cities. Have you ever foraged? Do you know what foraging is? Well, we have an expert with us.
Esme, this is a family show. There's a family show talking about foraging. Stop that.
Mike Kempenich is the gentleman forager. Mike, did I say your name correctly?
That's awful close. Kempenich, you bet.
Kempenich, okay. I love the gentleman forager. That sounds so poetic. Mike Kempenich, first of all, tell us, what is foraging and how did you become the gentleman forager?
Well, you know, foraging is really kind of a, in my mind, a play on farm to table, more forest to table. So whatever might be available on the season out in the woods or in the waters is the things that we're looking for all of our great restaurants here in town.
What? So you actually are out there foraging on a pretty regular basis?
Yes, we forage from May until basically November.
Okay, and past week or so, what have you managed to forage?
Well, springtime is really mostly about greens. The number of mushrooms that are up, of course, everybody's big on the morel, and it's kind of one of the first rites of spring, so everybody looks forward to it. But mushroom-wise, it's a little low, actually. It's not really a great time of the year. So lots of spring greens, watercress and nettles and whatever might be edible in the way of greens that are coming up.
And what do you do with the items that you find?
Well, we're a wholesale supplier to the restaurant industry, so.
And this is big. I mean, things like what are the ferns?
Fiddlehead.
Fiddlehead ferns.
Ramps.
I mean, I know asparagus is big, isn't it?
You bet. Sure.
And obviously the morels. So you actually sell them to the restaurants, and I know that this has really become big in terms of cuisine that people want these foods, don't they?
Well, yeah, I think everybody in recent years especially has tried to move towards a healthier diet and a local diet, and the sorts of products that we provide have really unique health benefits in addition to being really delicious. So I think it's just education over the years. More people are aware of the mushrooms and different types of mushrooms. When I was a kid, it was a white and button mushroom, and that was probably about it. But these days, people have probably tried five or six or more varieties. We sell up to 60 species of mushrooms.
And in terms of how do people know? And obviously, you've been doing this; you're an expert. How do people know that they are not getting the right thing? In other words, I believe there's a false morel, which isn't that poisonous?
Well, there are certainly toxic species of different mushrooms, and yes, in most states, and Minnesota included, you have to be certified in identifying those mushrooms. And some time back, I got involved with the state in trying to get some of those classes provided, and subsequently taught those classes for a few years. But I really began as a cultivator, so my interest began from foraging in the woods for Minnesota's wild mushrooms and then bringing them back to our labs and cultivating them for production year round, which was something, quite unique.
But you can't cultivate everything, can you?
No.
You can't cultivate morels, which is now how much does a pound of morels go for? I mean,
well, it's a bit like the seafood market and supply and demand, but on a year like this year, I see them around town for $40 to $60 a pound retail.
$40 to $60 a pound?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. And my husband came across a stash that was pretty nice. I don't know how. I mean, that's a pound of mushrooms is because they don't weigh very much, but he was very, very lucky in a completely unexpected place. And got some, but let me ask you, what are the rules? $40 to $60 a pound, yikes. What are the rules about picking mushrooms or ramps or any of these edibles in a public place or a park? Are there rules?
There absolutely are. In Minnesota, we're lucky enough to have a lot of public land, state parks and state forests most especially. And there it is legal to pick for personal consumption mushrooms, wild mushrooms. But plants are a whole nother
whole other story. There's really very few venues that are available to the public beyond private property to supply things like ramps.
Okay, but so in other words, but you can go to a state park or a national park even?
National park as well, you bet.
Okay, if you're using it for your own consumption.
Correct.
Okay, but if you want to, like for you, for the business side, you probably have to go and find somebody's, you know, property.
Yep, you have to sort of network. It's taken many years to sort of get to know people in different regions of the state. And, you know, many of them, when you get to talking about what it is you're looking to utilize your land for, find it sort of humorous and sort of shrug their shoulders, and then that's fine. And
Nobody asked for a cut?
Well, you know, there are others, I was going to say, who might be interested in a little taste, either a green or mushrooms. And, you know, that's fine, too. But, yeah, it's all about sort of networking. Although we hope here, and we've been working with the various national forests to make available commercial foraging licensing, which is, you know, widely available in the rest of the country.
All right. And in terms of that's so interesting, and the morel figures are amazing. But let me ask you because my husband and I actually really love morels, too. Why is it that they grow? I mean, is anyone understanding, like, why, you know, the place that's just a treasure trove one year is a bust the next?
Well, there's a really good, easy explanation for that. And morels are what's called a mycorrhizal mushroom, meaning they have a symbiotic relationship with a vascular plant. And in our case, certainly around the cities, that's typically an elm tree. And that organism lives underground year-round. It's interconnected with the roots of that tree. And it may live there for many, many years without the mushroom ever growing and you ever knowing that they exist there. It's only when the tree dies that a chemical signal is sent to that fungus, and it knows that its host is dying, and that's when it produces the fruit under the right conditions that we pick as morels.
And
so after that tree is dead for, you know, 3-4 years, you know, the organism is going to die with it, and that's why you no longer find them there.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense for our little stash then.
You'll have a few good years.
So we'll have a few good years. Okay. That is very interesting. That's exactly what occurred there. But you can't recreate those conditions, though, is what you're saying.
Well,
I imagine people, if it's $40 to $60 a pound for morel mushrooms, I bet you people have tried.
Well, it's been the holy grail of mushroom cultivation for sure. They are actually cultivating some morels in China right now, but having sampled them, they're interestingly tasteless.
Really?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So even though they may have, you know, reached a fruiting stage, which is scientifically very interesting, I'm not sure that it's, you know, it's ever going to take the place of a wild morel, even if they are able to scale it.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. And then also, ramps. What are ramps? Because I don't know if I would know what they were. And yet people are always talking about ramps.
Yeah, they're a really interesting combination of sort of onion and garlic combined. And they're really a wild leek. They grow in lowland wet areas around the state here, really pretty statewide with a few exceptions. And they're up for a very limited period of time, much like morels. They may be up for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks when they're really harvestable, and then the leaves will die back, and you wouldn't know they're there for the rest of the year. But if you've ever been or known somebody who has a big patch of them, they may complain every year that, oh, my God, the smell of onions is driving me insane. They're very pungent and really delicious in many ways in dishes.
And how about nettles?
Nettles are, you know, if you've ever been out in the woods as a kid with a pair of shorts on, going
yes.
up some high bushes and get those stinging deals on your arms or legs, those are stinging nettles. And that's another really, really healthy wild green that's harvestable, you know, really from spring until fall.
What kinds of things are they used?
It's very spinach-like. It's or they might make pesto.
Stinging nettles.
Yeah, once you've boiled them or applied heat to them, then the nettle bit goes away. So
well, I guess that's good.
Yeah, no itchy throat. You know, it's okay. All good.
So, are those the top? What are some of the others that people go for?
Watercress.
Oh, watercress. Yes,
really popular one. You know, that it's really can be used in many ways in salads and raw and garnishes and the like. But it's an interesting mix to a wild green salad. The fiddleheads, of course, are a favorite of a lot of people. If you've tried them, they're very much really asparagus-like. But, you know, it's hard when you describe these things because while they may have a certain flavor like asparagus, you know, they have a flavor of their own, too. And I think that's why people look forward to it so much every year. And it's been, again, very limited season that might only last 7 to 14 days until they're really completely unfurled and not usable.
Well, Micah Penick, you do have a website called The Gentleman Forager, and you actually offer classes?
Yes, we do classes, and we do group outings into the woods and bring along some chefs from town and some music usually. And we try and kind of bring the food and the people and the foraging all to one place.
Right. And what are these large mushrooms that, you know, I've seen them before, where they're growing out the side of trees?
Well, are they orange or are they brown and black?
They are brown and black.
That would be commonly, that's called a hen of the woods. That's, or you might call it maitake, that's Gryphula frondosa.
Wow. Well, your website is very, very cool. And is this something, all these things that we're seeing here on your website, those are things that grow here in Minnesota?
Those are all photographs I've taken of mushrooms in Minnesota, you bet.
And those are all edible?
Not all of them.
Okay, good, because I was saying some of them look a little scary.
Well, they're all edible, some only once.
Okay, that's good. That's good, because it's, and these are beautiful photographs. But and your classes, are they in the metro or, you know, across the state?
They are, actually. We have one coming up June 14th at Paul's Market in Apple Valley.
All right, well, very, very interesting. Stuff and the website's just gorgeous.
Thank you.
Gentleman Forager, Mike Kempenick, and his website is gentlemanforager.com. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we are going to be joined by, I believe it's pronounced Chris Mazena, who is the host of the Morel Fest that's coming up. So if you are interested in like actually eating some of these things that we are talking about, maybe you can find them all there. So keep it right here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. All right, so we've been talking about Morel mushrooms. Showing off the picture of the morel mushrooms that my husband found at a secret location. For those of you who don't have a secret location that is yielding morels, well, guess what? You can go to Morel Fest. Chris Mozina is the executive director of, and rather host of Morel Fest, and is joining us right now. Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you, Esme.
All right, so tell us about Morel Fest and where it's going to be and the genesis of it.
Well, it is going to be, it's a two-day event, actually. It's Morel Feast on Friday, June 2nd, which is an event featuring a number of local award-winning chefs all gathering to prepare their favorite preparations of this woodland delicacy. And it's, you know, there's wine and craft beer pairings as well.
That sounds good.
It's going to be good. It's limited. There's only a handful of tickets left, but it's... I'm happy to say that there is interest and enthusiasm about the morel yet. And then Saturday, June 3rd, is the actual Morel Fest, which is an indoor-outdoor music arts culinary event.
Oh, okay, so there's a Morel Feast and a Morel Fest.
Correct.
Oh, okay, now I'm with you. And it's going to be at the Hook and Ladder?
Yes, and both of them combined constitute our first real fundraising foray. We are a new nonprofit community theater that started back in September.
Okay, so there's going to be a Morel Feast and a Morel Fest. And do you need tickets to both?
The Morel Feast is limited in tickets, and you do have to have a ticket in advance. And we're asking people to purchase them by 5 p.m. Monday so we can work with Mike, your previous guest, to source them and have them ready to the chefs in time to prepare them for folks on Friday evening. But for Saturday's festival, which is 2 to 10 p.m., it's just a small suggested donation, if you can, at the gate to help support us. Otherwise, it's free music and fun, and there will be fried morels available.
Wow. Okay. And we just heard Mike say... and I think a lot of people are going to be interested in your Morel Fest, that things are a little dicey when it comes to finding morels these days, or this season.
They are, and I personally have been skunked thus far this year, and I'm originally from Iowa, and their season happens a little bit earlier than ours, so it's largely come and gone. But Mike's a resourceful guy, and he's got pickers all over the country. So it's a good chance the morels that we're serving will come from a combination of states, including the upper Midwest and even the upper Pacific Coast.
Wow. Okay. And so you've got four chefs here, and you want it, and this is all at the Hook and Ladder, which is the Hook and Ladder Theater, which is 3010 Minnehaha Avenue. And you just opened your theater company.
Yes, we came into existence back in September, and have been kind of ramping up the level of activity and programming that we've done since then, and are kind of hitting critical mass now, where we're busy with events Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in the theater and in the adjoining lounge, various performances of all kinds. In fact, it might get loud throughout the course of this conversation, because there's a sound check going on downstairs okay. right now.
Well, let me ask you this, and the Morel Feast, 7 to 11, the tickets are not inexpensive. I mean, it's $80. However, obviously, we just heard Mike say that a pound of Morels is going for like $40 on
up. Actually, yeah, I saw them for $60 at the farmer's market last weekend, and I didn't see them today. Now, I may have just missed them when I was here this morning, or they may have sold out by the time I got there.
Yeah, Mike said that they were, I guess we kind of sold ours. We just ate them. I think we've got, Mike did say it was $40 to $60 a pound, but it is like, it looks like an amazing, amazing menu. I do have to ask you about one item on the menu.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got morel masala with rice. So that sounds great. The smoked trout stuffed with morel tempura. Mm. Going down here, prosciutto wrapped asparagus with lemon morel butter. That sounds really good. Morel ice cream. Help me out here.
Yeah, well, I was just as surprised to hear those words put together myself for the first time. But they were strung together by a chef in town, Jim Kindberg, who is the chef at Radisson Blu downtown Minneapolis right now. In a previous incarnation, was the proprietor of Bayport Cookery up just south of Stillwater.
Oh yeah.
And he had a Morel Feast menu where he had that restaurant had.
This is a top.
Yes.
Restaurant.
And so he did a 6 or 7 course Morel meal for a couple of months every year there. And I had his Morel mousse in the past, which knocked my socks off. And so basically he went out and foraged for himself, found about a pound plus of local morels, and I provided him a pound, and he dehydrated them, put them through a coffee grinder, and has been steeping heavy cream in that morel dust for several days, and will strain, and I believe he's putting together 5 or 6 gallons of it for people to try.
And is it going to be sweet or savory?
Oh, no, it's most certainly a sweet.
With morel dust?
Yeah. It's, you know, some of them have a pecan-y, nutty, walnut-y, maple-y flavor to them. And he's pretty particular, and he goes through and smells each one before it passes muster and makes it into the ice cream.
Wow. Okay. Well, that certainly, that really sounds like that is going to be quite the event. And then the next day is when you don't need tickets for a suggested donation, but you will be able to, I guess, purchase some morels.
Yeah, until they're gone, you know.
Well, until they're gone.
Until they're gone, and that's always the scarcity is what drives price at the market and in the restaurants, and we'll be locking in and getting a large number of them, and we're going to try and make them as affordable as possible. The goal is to allow folks that maybe have never had a morel before, which is in fact our state mushroom.
It's the state mushroom.
It.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
but
right.
There's a lot of work to find them.
I've forgotten it was
Tick Bloom. Given those prices at $80 matched with all you can drink wine and craft beer, I think it's a pretty great deal. And there is a very cool art installation happening in the theater. It's going to be transformed into an electric forest by a local artist. And there is going to be some live entertainment from Parasota Hot Club, too.
Well, that sounds very, very cool. And if you just want to Google Morel Feast or even Morel Fest, it will take you that. And you're saying that tickets are very limited for that Friday event.
They are. They've been selling pretty rapidly the last few days, and there's not a whole lot left, but there's a few left. And if you've not tried them, or you have tried them and really want to, you know, immerse yourself in fungus for the night, it's money well spent. And it goes to a great cause, supporting the hook and liner.
Okay, well, listen, Chris Mazina, thank you so much, and good luck with the entire event. It sounds like it's going to be a huge hit.
Thank you, Esme. Appreciate
it. Okay, take care. All right, just a quick Morrell story about one of my favorite people, Don Shelby, who never does anything halfway. He went out and, of course, said, you know, he was going to do a story, brought a camera with him that would jinx most people. He found all these Morrells. And instead of just kind of cooking up himself, Don marches across the street from WCCO-TV to Vincent's, which was no longer in business, but a fabulous French restaurant, and had Vincent cook up the Morrells for him. Only Don. All right, folks, keep it here. Coming up next, the one and only Professor David Schultz, the latest in the Russia investigation.